From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
We produce, as American farmers, food cheaper than any other country in the world as it relates to our income, yet we have the highest health care in the world. There's a conundrum. There's a direct correlation with the way that we're trying to farm and feed our country and the health or the lack thereof of our country.
Farmer Lee Jones has seen it all. His family story is really an American tale. A small family farm transitions to enormous acreage, only to lose it all and start over. The act of rebuilding allowed his family to rethink the way they grew food. They started growing for flavor, and the result is the Chef's Garden, a highly specialized parcel of land set a few miles inland from Lake Erie. Its primary goal is to fulfill the desires of the most discerning chefs in the world. And Farmer Lee Jones, with his trademark overalls and red bow tie, is the best ambassador any farm could have. Hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, we're thrilled that you're here. The story of the farm is so fascinating. Could you tell us a bit about it, how far it goes back, who started it?
Well, our family's been in the farming for probably six generations, although there's been gaps. My dad actually went to work for a very progressive vegetable grower. And if you go back further than that, we're in an amazing microclimate right along Lake Erie in Huron, Ohio. And Lake Erie is the shallowest of all the Great Lakes. Consequently, it's the warmest. In fact, we were huge in wine grapes before Napa Valley. And it did not last. But we had, at one point, over 330 truck farmers that grew vegetables in this community and then served the large metropolitan areas, because the microclimate of Lake Erie provides nice, warm, gentle breezes off the lake. And it also allows us to extend the season later into the fall and keeps us from freezing out early. As well, we're on old lake bottom soil, some of the richest sandy loam in the world. And we really think that the cool climates allow us to provide really, really special vegetables. The spinach, I wish that you could actually feel and hear and taste and touch the spinach. We plant it in the fall. It winters over. We actually have a trademark on ice spinach, much like the concept of ice wine, where they harvest the grape frozen. And the spinach is actually testing as sweet as a red delicious apple. And you actually, I mean, when you squeeze it, it's just got so much body and crunch and dark green, and it just screams of health.
Wow. Wow. Someday I have to come and visit. I understand that, like many farmers, you were affected by the farm crises of the 80s.
We were. My dad actually went to work for a progressive vegetable grower named Charles Nichols. And as if you can imagine, 330 vegetable growers in the 1930s, it's hard for us to even think about or consider. But roads and refrigeration had not developed to the point where there was a lot of outside competition. So you had Cleveland an hour away, Toledo an hour away, Columbus 2 hours away, Detroit an hour and a half, Pittsburgh 3.5 hours, Cincinnati 4 hours. So you had these large metropolitan areas without a lot of outside competition from California or Florida or Georgia or the Carolinas. And so those farmers did quite well. But as the roads and refrigeration continued to improve, outside competition happened, because it was growers on larger scale of 10,000 or 20 or 30,000 acre farms could do it more efficiently than the truck farmers here that were farming 100 to 200 acres was a large farm. And so one by one, those small family farms went out. Mr. Nichols recognized this competition coming, so he worked cooperatively with about 65 other growers, and Dad learned a lot from him and ultimately ended up 20 some years later buying the farm from Mr. Nichols, because he had no one in the family that wanted to carry the business on. And so my dad was farming about 1200 acres in the late 70s and early 80s. And, you know, one by one, the small family farms, the 330 in the 1930s, just slowly were going away. Much like if the listeners can think of going back to their hometown and thinking about the number of family-owned grocery stores that once existed, that were really pushed out by larger chain grocery stores. My dad supplied chain grocery stores. And if you can imagine, today interest rates have been at really at a historic low. They're right around 3.5, 3.75. In the late 70s, early 80s, the economy got turned all upside down. And the interest rates actually hit 22%. And there was a fellow by the name of Earl Butz, the Secretary of Agriculture for the United States. And his message to farmers was to get big or get out. And everything was really kind of working against us. We were selling to places like Kroger and Pick and Pay, very large chains that had hundreds of stores. They had a lot of buying power. And we were borrowing money at 22%. And those chain grocery stores would pay us in about 120 days. So basically, we were borrowing it at 22% and loaning it to them for 120 days with no interest. Then to kind of finish us off, we had a very devastating hailstorm and it wiped out all the crops. And I stood at 19 years old with my mother and father and my brother and sister and all of our neighbors and all of our competitors and everybody that was there to celebrate our failure. And they auctioned off every single thing that we owned, every tractor, every piece of equipment, my mother's car, and ultimately our home. And we literally crawled away. It's not a rags to riches story. That's not what I'm trying to paint here. But we started over and we met a lady by the name of Iris Balin, who was a trained professional chef. She had trained in Europe. And she was going to farmers markets, which ironically were at a historic low in the 70s and 80s. And she knew we were desperate for a way to be able to figure out how to survive in agriculture. And she said, you know, I really believe there would be enough chefs that would support you if you would grow it the right way. Grow for the flavor, grow for the integrity of the product, grow it without chemical, grow it for flavor, grow it for flavor, grow it for flavor. Repeatedly, that was the message. And we latched on to both of her ankles and said, teach us. And we wouldn't let go. And she introduced us to a chef and then to another and then to another, which led us to California, of course, with many chefs there. But obviously, Thomas Keller has done an awfully lot for us. He's been on our farm and is a great mentor to me and has done an awful lot for our family.
What an incredible and compelling story. I'm really curious to hear your father, Bob Sr.'s farming philosophy.
Well, one of the things that he said was that the only thing that we're trying to do is get as good as the growers were 100 years ago. And if you think about that, a large farm was about 100 acres. Our goal is not to be big, it's to be good. It's to be the best that we can to provide the most nutritious vegetables that we can. And, you know, on a 100-acre farm 100 years ago, that was a big farm because that's about all one family could manage. And a third of that was in pasture to feed the animals. One third of it was sitting fallow, harvesting the sun's energy to rebuild the soil. And a third of it was in production. And then the next year they rotated. So you're always rebuilding. It's like a relationship with a human being. We can't take and not give back. When we lost the farm, a lot of our information came from agricultural books that was 100 to 150 years old. But it was going back and rebuilding the soil. And it's been pretty amazing. We're obviously using technology today that wasn't available 100 years ago. And we take advantage of that because we can. But we can test the soil just like if you were to go and have blood work drawn, find out what the deficiencies are. We can plant crop specific alfalfa, buckwheat, barley, vetch, clover. We have a 15 species cover crop that we'll plant. Two thirds of our acreage in any one year is committed to harvesting the sun's energy. And you can rebuild naturally rather than chemically. And we're testing right here on the farm, and we're seeing nutrient levels 300 to 500% higher than the USDA average. Unfortunately, if you Google nutritional information on vegetables from 1930 to 1980, the nutritional levels in vegetables has gone down by 50%, and it continues to go down at an increasing rate.
Can you talk a bit about how you go about finding and trialing new varieties for chefs?
Well, one of my dad's sayings was always that we have to continue to make mistakes at a faster rate than the competition. He also said that we do mistakes quite well. But, you know, early on, chefs were telling us things about things like radicchio or Herkovert beans, things that were really uncommon to the United States and especially to the Midwest. And on this sandy loam, we kind of have the attitude that we can grow about anything. And we trial literally hundreds of varieties. I remember one year where we did over 100 varieties of garlic. We've done hundreds of thousands of varieties of tomatoes. You plant a few and you try them and we get them out to chefs and they tell us thumbs up, thumbs down, or you're onto something and keep going. Once we figured out to really start and look and explore, we build a facility called the Culinary Vegetable Institute. We have about 600 visiting chefs a year, and they can do R&D and play and experiment in a kitchen. And it's just really, it's about testing and trying things and just constantly be trying. But it's also about, you know, food waste is one of the biggest issues that we face in America. I think everybody by now has seen the 40% food waste commercials. And I think that that probably underestimates it. But also, I think we kind of think one-dimensionally. We think of a carrot only being one size or a zucchini squash one size. We've learned that at every single stage of a plant's life, it offers something unique to the plate. If you can imagine a Brussels sprout, it gets 3 to 4 feet tall. It's a beautiful plant, absolutely beautiful. And you have this gorgeous canopy of leaves that flow down over to provide an umbrella to keep the Brussels sprout from being sunburned. And all we do is pick off the little Brussels sprout off of this plant that's taken 9 to 10 months to grow, and the whole rest of the plant is wasted. Think of the energy, think of the water, think of all the time that's gone into growing this beautiful plant. Well, it's in the cruciferous family, the leaf. I would defy you to be able to tell the difference in a blind test, the difference between a Brussels sprout leaf, a collard green, a broccoli, or a cauliflower leaf. All of those are edible and in the greens family, and they're delicious. And we, you know, we have recognized that we can use the bone marrow from an animal, but we've actually discovered that the marrow from the Brussels sprout stalk is quite edible. I think it's really, the book is kind of exciting to get people to look at plants in different ways and considering the tops of a radish or looking at that plant at a different stage than we've ever thought about before.
I want to thank you so much, Farmer Lee. I mean, this has been just the most lovely conversation. And thank you so much for giving us this book to chew over.
I am just so grateful that you allowed me on, and anytime I get to talk vegetables, it's always an exciting day for me. So thank you so very much, and encourage everybody to eat their veggies.
That was Farmer Lee Jones talking about his gorgeous new tome, The Chef's Garden. Farmer Lee has an entire section of his book dedicated to edible flowers, most of which are in season right now at our local farmers markets. We head to the market to find out what's blooming when Good Food continues. Welcome back to Good Food. It's that time when we head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market, this time to quite literally smell the flowers. Jillian Ferguson is there now with her weekly report.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. I am back in Santa Monica this week with Sarah Sims, who along with her twin sister Boo, runs Lady & Larder in Mar Vista. Lady & Larder is a full-service cheese shop, and they are responsible for the gorgeous charcuterie and crudité boards that you may have seen on your Instagram feed. Sarah buys a ton of her ingredients here at the market, but today I want to focus on what I like to call the glitter of the farmer's market, edible flowers. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, it's so true, the glitter. I love that.
So before we get started on the flowers, I'd love for you to just describe the shop for us. What is the philosophy behind it?
Our, you know, general ethos is that we like to really celebrate a strong sense of place. So we're 100% domestic. We use zero imported products. All of our cheesemakers, it's a heavy focus on California, but we support the entire United States. And then all of our produce, fruit, dried nuts, comes 100% from the local farmer's market or a relationship with the local farmer. And so we're here weekly at the market, just getting a pulse on what's happening and what's in season. And I brought you flowers to see today, what we found. There's so many things. It's like peak spring. Stone fruit showed up today. It's lots of magic happening at the market.
There sure is. Okay, so in front of us is this spread of flowers that you've picked up today. What do we have here on the left side?
So So first we have from Peter Shaner, the most stunning tie-dye purple and violet violas, which are about the size of a quarter. They get down to the size of a dime, and they are showstoppers. We use them on almost all of our boards and salads at the shop.
All right, and then up next, it looks like we have maybe some pea flowers.
Yes, pea tendrils, which these are from Farmer Paul, who works with Mike at McGrath, and he just started his own farm. So these tendrils are from him. We've been buying purple ones that just finished this week from John and Vinny's farm, Yerba Buena, out in Malibu. And yes, we're seeing fava tendrils, pea tendrils, beautiful right now. Great time to buy them. And then next we have flowering cilantro, which today has this like purple hue going on. They're usually tiny white flowers. So we have the coriander seeds also there. We use these ones on our crudité boards.
Beautiful. And do you keep that coriander on the stem like that? Or do you take it off and use it? You do?
I do, because I like to eat when the coriander is really young like this, you can eat it and it has this really bright, beautiful cilantro-y young coriander flavor. You could also pull them off, dry them. And then when they're fully dry, you can toast them and grind them and use them as you would in any normal recipe with coriander, which is great. And then next we have a classic that is also from Peter Shaner. This is French lavender. We tuck these into our gift baskets, which we do a lot of. We have Mother's Day coming up this weekend. And then, how stunning is this? This is culinary sage, and it's flowering right now and has these stunning purple flowers coming off it that almost look like the flowers you see on like a watermelon radish or arugula flower. And those can be picked off and used individually or sprinkled over your hummus or salad as well.
How do you pick which flower goes where? Is it just the whim of the moment, or are you really thinking about color? How does it work?
Yeah, so we very much think about color and then the design element and how the flower is laid out. It's not just like a random situation. And then a lot has to do with, you know, if we're doing a salad, we might get calendula or bachelor buttons and then not use them as a whole flower, but pull the petals apart and you get all these little micro petals and flowers, which are really beautiful tossed into greens. And then we use larger flowers that are a little bit more stable on the cheese boards. And a final note, I was talking to the team over at Shaner, is a lot of people say to them, well, why can't I just like pick these in my neighborhood when you see pansies growing? And you want to make sure when you are buying edible flowers that they're from a no-spray farm that don't have pesticides, because you're eating them in raw form and you don't want to get sick.
Thank you for saying that. That's a really important point. Sarah, this is great. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jillian. Such an honor to be on this show with you.
That was Sarah Sims with her sister, Boo. She runs Lady and Larder on Sautel in Mar Vista. They're a full-service cheese shop. And big news, they are opening a second location on Pico near Lincoln, coming soon. So as Sarah mentioned, there are a lot of farmers who bring edible flowers here to the market, but you can also grow your own. And Logan Williams of Logan's Gardens brings a number of starts to the market every single week, including a bunch of flowers this time of year. Hi, Logan.
Hey, how you doing there?
I'm good. So let's start with the nasturtiums, which I see everywhere this time of year. What varieties did you bring today?
Oh gosh, we too many to name. We do so many different varieties. For example, today I have a variety called Mahogany, which is an incredible deep reddish, burgundy-ish reddish sort of a color. I have another variety called Milkmaid, which is like an off-white, slightly speckled flower. So we do a wide range of different nasturtium flowers specifically, all of which are edible in multiple different forms, not just the flowers themselves, but the leaves are edible in cooking, as are the young flower buds. A lot of times, a lot of restaurants will even dry them in a pepper-like fashion, and you can even put them in your pepper mill after drying them and grind them up and use them as like an alternative to pepper. Even past just those guys, we do a lot of other things that flower and or you use the flowers in cooking. So things like barrage, for example, that gets used in a lot of different salad mixes and whatnot nowadays. The leaves even get muddled in an old-fashioned English drink called a Pim's cup. It's a drink that you still see sold at bars nowadays. A lot of times they'll replace the barrage with actually cucumber. So if you get a Pim's cup with cucumber, you tell them this is not correct. Yep.
And I understand that with the borage plant is also a beneficial companion plant to tomatoes. When you plant them in the garden with the tomatoes, it keeps some of the bugs away, right?
Well, barrage in general does attract a lot of the same bugs that will normally go or gravitate towards your tomatoes, let's say. A lot of those guys will actually go to your barrage. So it's kind of interesting one. It's kind of like that's almost using the barrage as like a sacrificial plant almost. But all of the flowering herbs, for example, do a great, great job of attracting bees, to be totally honest. So even something like, for example, I do about 4 different varieties of lavender. I have an English purple. I have a pink variety. I have a lighter purple variety. All of those do a great job of attracting bees. All of those guys are also just smell great in the garden. And then there's even other plants that people don't really think about using the flowers so much. Like a lot of the different allium family plants have beautiful flowers that are also used culinarily. I do chives. I do garlic chives. But even past that, I do other alliums like your leeks. I do red scallions. I do green scallions. All those guys, if you don't pull them for the root crop and you leave the tops, will actually eventually flower. You can use the flowers, and you can use technically any allium. You can use the tops of their plant, of the plant, kind of as a chive substitute, so to speak. So you can use the tops as well as the flowers in cooking. Yeah.
I've seen people actually tempura batter those flowers and deep fry them, which is stunning to see.
That sounds delicious, actually. You're making me quite hungry.
Thank you so much, Logan.
Oh, thank you so much as well.
That was Logan Williams of Logan's Gardens. He and his dad, Jimmy, are at the Wednesday Santa Monica and Saturday Santa Monica downtown markets and Hollywood on Sundays. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
And yes, Lady & Larder does still have Mother's Day gift baskets available, but I'd give them a call as soon as you can if you're interested. We all know this weekend is Mother's Day, and if those Instagram ads are doing their jobs, a lot of you are buying gifts and sending bouquets. It's easy to be cynical about how the ad agencies turned Mother's Day into a sales opportunity, but really, who can argue with a day devoted to acknowledging motherhood? The only downside is that it only happens once a year. As I dove into Lindsay Gardner's new book, Why We Cook, I thought this is the perfect gift for anyone struggling to what to get mom this Mother's Day. The subtitle is Women on Food, Identity, and Connection. Lindsay's an artist and illustrator, and her book celebrates 112 women cooks. She joins us this morning with the story of how this particular journey came to be.
You know, when I think back on the last 3 years, I always come back to it starting in my own kitchen. I am a mom. I have 2 daughters. They're 5 and 8 years old now. But of course, we're 3 years younger then. And I found that when I was cooking for them and cooking for our family, I started having a lot of questions and new thoughts about cooking that I hadn't really had earlier in my life. And I started to wonder why. I also was exploring sort of the overlaps between what drew me to cooking, the creative process of cooking, and the same impulses that draw me to painting in my studio. I also was thinking a lot about how many different roles women carry in their lives, especially now, and how I was balancing all those different parts of my own life. So it was really a lot of different factors that came together and resulted in a bunch of questions, really. And when I have questions that I'm trying to figure out, I tend to take them into my studio to try to work them out. I also spent a lot of time talking with other women in my life about some of these things that I was wrestling with. And then those conversations sort of just naturally expanded. And I felt like, you know, there's really something here that I want to explore more. So that's really where it started.
There are so many side hustles in food, and so many people who work within it or work with food are multifaceted. It seems to be a dominant characteristic of a lot of the women that you profile. Can you tell us a bit about Abby Fuller and her work? She was the first female director of Netflix's Chef's Table and a documentary, Another Perfect Day.
Yes, she is such a great example of that multifaceted, multi-talented profile of person that you're describing. Abby, as you say, directed a couple of, I think she's directed 4 Netflix chef's tables. She did Anna Ross and Mashama Bailey, Christina Martinez. And when I reached out to her, I was really interested in her perspective from that sort of storytelling angle, because that's a big part of what she does, obviously. But she ended up telling me about her experience going to direct and film in Slovenia with Anna Ross. And that turned out to be a very life-changing experience for her, that when she came back to the States after finishing filming the episode, really caused her to sort of reshape her entire life. She left LA, she moved to Virginia and helped her, I think he was her fiance, now her husband, start a regenerative cattle farm that they now own and operate together. And she sort of lives this dual life between storytelling, and she focuses mostly on the stories of women and food, but also environmental stories of sustainability and movements within that. And then also this directorial career. And so she talked to me a lot about her sort of fluctuations between city life and farm life. And I think she just really embodies this sort of characteristic of a lot of the women in the book who see everything that they do as interconnected.
We look to many of the women that you've included as pillars of the culinary community, but they also have their own heroes. Polina Chesnokova describes the term mother man in her essay, Dedikatsi. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Can you explain the term and where other women you interviewed found role models?
Absolutely. So, you know, I don't want to speak for Polina, but the way that I understand it based on how she wrote about it is this concept of Georgian women and the strength of the women that sort of led families and lead families in Georgia. And in her case, the women in her family and their immigration to the U.S. and sort of how they're the culture bearers and were able to hold down the fort in times of real challenge. I think that this theme of motherhood came through organically, and many of the women in the book point to their mothers or their grandmothers or strong women in their personal lives as role models. And I think for me, that is a real connection point between the women working in the professional culinary sphere and the home cooks represented in the book. There are examples like Bonnie Sui, who talks about ginger as an ingredient and how that ingredient connects her to her heritage, and how when she makes tea, it reminds her of her mother. Or Rachel Kong, who writes this beautiful essay about her mom's habit of cutting fruit for her and her brother growing up, and how her hands smelled like garlic, and then the smell of garlic was always on the fruit. There are ways that those stories of sort of the things that we inherited from the matriarchs in our families, those come through in a lot of the contributors' reflections.
Could you please read what Irene Lee says about cooking?
Sure. So Irene says, "I don't really think of cooking in terms of failure or success. It's just a process and an experience. At the end, you're different than when you began. You've grown or learned, but not because you've failed or succeeded."
Yeah, I mean, aside from essays and recipes, there are these brief interludes of quick conversation that almost have a speed round quality, or just thoughts like that one you just read from Irene Lee. For example, you asked food truckers about the best thing being mobile. What were some of the most enlightening responses?
You know, something I really had never thought about with food truck chefs and owners and operators is the intimacy of the experience that is so much a part of that kind of situation. And that was something I think that came up in a few people's responses on that page, was just being able to relate to their clients and their customers in a really direct way and have the people that come to the food trucks, their patrons, see them in a really direct way and see what they're doing so closely. A few people described sort of having repeat customers and how the engagement in that scenario is so different than what it might be like in a restaurant. And of course, that's really interesting right now in the midst of the pandemic and how much our sense of going in and out of restaurants has changed or being in restaurants has changed. So I found that really surprising and sort of a wonderful way of thinking about approaching food trucks.
It's really a wonderful book. And I have to say, for people struggling to find something to give their mother on Mother's Day, this is actually, I think, a really thoughtful gift.
Thank you so much.
That's Lindsay Gardner. Accompanied by her illustration, she's collected essays, interviews, and recipes of and from women at the center of the modern culinary zeitgeist. Her book is Why We Cook. In a minute, during the pandemic, food writer Eric Kim moved back in with his mom to solicit her help on his upcoming cookbook. He recounts what happened when Good Food Continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Mother knows best, or so the old adage goes. During the pandemic, Eric Kim returned home to ask his mom for help on a cookbook chapter he was writing. Little did he know that he would unearth a treasure trove of ingredients and techniques that he took for granted when he ate her food as a small child. He documented his maternal culinary education in a recent piece for the New York Times. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Can you set up the circumstances of moving back home from New York to Atlanta and how long you initially intended to stay?
Sure. I think, you know, first of all, the pandemic was probably a big reason because I just really wanted to be with my family and, you know, I missed them. But ultimately, I did have this book deal to write down my family recipes, which are happen to be Korean recipes and also Korean American recipes. But yeah, ultimately, I knew that I had to be back there to really walk through my mother's portion of the recipes because they require you know, weeks and weeks of fermentation and a really close eye and visual cues, and just so many things you can, there are only so many things you can do, you know, over the phone, which is how I had been doing it for a few months. But a month-long stay turned into 9 months. So it was a surprise to all of us, but it was definitely, it was a blessing in disguise. It wasn't really in disguise, actually. It was a huge blessing.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people who ended up hibernating with their families. Before your return, what do you remember about your mom, Jean's cooking for you and your brother?
You know, it is interesting. I thought I knew so much more about her cooking than I realized I did as I started actually cooking with her and finding the details. You know, I just assumed that she put a lot of sugar in her food because her food has kind of a sweet quality. And that's ultimately one reason why I also love when food has balance, not just salty and sour, but also sweet. And I also think it's a nice feature of Korean flavors. Balance is really important, but the one ingredient that I really realized she relied on was maesilchang, which is this green plum syrup. And she also has a bunch of other syrups. She grows blueberries in her backyard, so she makes a blueberry syrup. She made a pineapple syrup that she warned me not to use in, you know, a beef marinade because fresh pineapple melts meat. So I tried that once, and because I didn't believe her because I'm a bad son. But I tried it, and the beef totally melted into a glue on my grill. It was really pretty gross. That's one big thing. I just assumed she used white sugar, you know, growing up. But nope, she uses these syrups.
We should say that when you refer to meat melting from pineapple, it's because of its tenderizing capabilities.
Yeah, exactly, right. There's an enzyme called bromelain, and it's actually quite specific to pineapple. I think there are some tenderizers on the market that have pineapple and papaya and fruits like that. But the one in pineapple especially is very, very effective. So, Yeah.
And the meat that you were cooking was probably sliced very thin.
Yeah, exactly. It was it was bulgogi, which is a pretty popular Korean dish. It's usually very thinly sliced and sold in Korean markets like that. But especially a meat like that, that was a good example or a good lesson that I learned. Never marinate bulgogi in pineapple. It's very dangerous.
So I love that you discovered that your mother was this much more complex creature in the kitchen than you imagined that she was. Could you talk about the pot roast principle and the critical instruction, that's the way my mother did it, that's so prevalent among family recipes that are passed down?
Yeah, sure. To back up a little bit, the reason I even found that was because I just started at the Times maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and one of my heroes, probably the food writing hero, is Nigella Lawson. And so as I started kind of looking into the archives at the Times and their food section, I would run into these old Nigella columns, and they're so lovely, and the way she writes is so timeless. But that she does have one particular column about inheritance, and I thought that'd be perfect to sort of weave into this conversation about motherhood. And the pot roast principle is this funny allegory about a cook who cuts off the ends of a roast because her mother does it, or his mother. And then the person asks their mother and finds out that the mother only does it because their mother does it. And then, you know, you go down a couple times and you realize that the only reason the grandmother or the great-grandma does it is because her pot or her oven is or was too small. And ultimately saying, like, we do some things because of just blind faith. And I think that's probably safest in the kitchen, especially. You should always listen to your mom. But when writing a cookbook, for instance, and, you know, really needing to explain why you're doing certain things, it felt like reporting. I basically spent 8 months reporting on my mother's cooking and on our family past. It was lovely to sort of tease out of her why she in particular does certain things, and to get her to really think about why she puts pine nuts in her kimchi. And, you know, just to be clear, of course, the reason the book deal happened and the reason I wrote that proposal is because I think my mom's a genius, and she's always been the good cook. Like, we have, you know, many communities, Korean communities in Georgia, and whether it's like her church or her, you know, her work or her, you know, or our family, which is a very big section of Atlanta, I would say, very extended family. She's always been known as the cook. And you can take that for granted, I think, when you're growing up with that food. And my cousin described it to me funnily. She was saying that she thought that it was normal for parents to just be really good at cooking, but she realized later in life, as she married and, you know, inherited a mother-in-law and like stuff like that, realizing that it actually is not ubiquitous to be good at cooking.
Yeah, I when I think about cooking of the kind that your mother does, I think of the rhythms that are so deep in it, probably, and how for me, for example, making one of her dishes might be a project because I have to actually procure and make every part of what goes into the overall recipe, including any sub-recipes. Whereas someone who's fluent in a cuisine has so much either already done, or the way they approach a dish is to work on it in sort of more easily accessible bites as they're doing something else.
Yeah, that's a good point. She certainly has 20 jars of kimchi in her 5 refrigerators in Georgia. It's not really like one end point and like you do it once and then you're done. It's cumulative. And, you know, I think a lot of Korean cooking is like that, especially Korean home cooking, you know, banchan, which is all those gorgeous little dishes that come out. You don't make those all in one night. You make them, you know, you make them cumulatively. Like, you make maybe one or two one night and then you store the rest in the fridge. And eventually you have this store of wonderful ingredients. And like a lot of those vegetable banchan can be used for bibimbap. And so it is funny though, when you go to her house, especially her kimchi fridge, when you're trying to put a jar back, or even like tiny Tupperware, like you kind of can't because there's no room. So she has to play Tetris. She's like, no, give it to me. And she knows how to do it because it's like, she knows her fridge and it's a game of Tetris, which is kind of wild.
Yeah. I love that. So when can we expect to see your first cookbook?
It has a slated date of March 2022, so next year. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to its publication so we can have you back and you can go into all this in much more detail.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Eric Kim is a cooking writer for the New York Times Food Desk and New York Times Cooking. During the pandemic, he moved back home, worked on his cookbook, Korean American, and spent time in the kitchen cooking alongside his mom. We've heard a lot of warm and fuzzy stories about spending time in the kitchen alongside mom, but imagine turning that sweet, syrupy story into a business plan. Keegan Fong did just that. Woon Kitchen is his collaboration with his mother, Julie Chen Fong, aka Mama Fong. Keegan's background in fashion marketing combined with Mama Fong's creativity behind the wok has made Woon a destination for craveable beef noodles. But then, of course, COVID threw some curveballs. Keegan and Mama Fong are here for this week's In the Weeds.
My name's Keegan Fong, and I am the owner of Woon in Filipino Town.
Hi, I am Julie Fong, also known as Mama Fong. I'm a mother of Keegan, who is the owner of Woon, and I am the executive chef there, supposedly.
The journey of opening Woon is quite long, but I would say it first started as kind of a passion side project. I would go home and kind of want something to work on other than my day job. So I just came up with the concept of my mom's noodle shop, and I would work on a business plan every night I came home just to keep my wheels turning. And eventually that became a reality when we were presented with an opportunity to become a pop-up. We hosted pop-ups throughout LA on the weekends whenever we had time. We'd be in different bars and venues, and we frequented this alleyway in Koreatown behind our friend's studio called Pico Studio. So we'd host random noodle pop-ups and BYOB and DJs and everything. And that kind of turned into a little underground thing for us that we did every other month or so. And eventually I felt like I wanted to try and take the leap and change gears in my career and try and make Woon an actual brick and mortar. And I convinced my mom, or actually forced her, to be the executive chef behind this concept. And built Woon from the ground up with friends and family, and obviously my mom at the helm with her recipes.
Well, my involvement actually started when we had our, you know, the cart and everything. So yes, I was involved in the beginning with my noodles when we were doing the noodle pop-ups. But as far as the concept of having a restaurant is concerned, I'm pretty skeptical because I've never been working in a restaurant before, and I kind of have reservations about it. But Keegan's determination convinced me that it's going to be okay. You know, I could do it in a professional kitchen because I've been always a home cook, you know, behind the kitchen at home. So that's a big leap for me. As a boy, Keegan was not really involved in any of the cooking or anything. He was, you know, skateboarding, going snowboarding and all that. But he would always come home and ask for food. You know, he wanted my comfort food. So I would make him like some kind of a Chinese dish, you know, like a wrap, you know, that he could put in the fridge and just come home and take a bite out of it when he's hungry. So there's always food in the kitchen, and there's always food available for him and his sister. Wherever mama is, there is food. So it's a comfort thing for him.
I remember my mom in the kitchen, just being in the kitchen all the time. I feel like whenever I think back on the house I grew up in, you know, I was always looking for my mom, and she would be in the kitchen. I remember opening the refrigerator and just coming back from school and finding the tofu cucumber salad that we serve at Woon. Like, I would just always open it, and there'd be a Tupperware full of tofu cucumber salad that I would just eat. And then also waking up, you know, my mom always said breakfast was the most important meal of the day. And if I had a test that day, she would make me a giant bowl of like instant ramen. But it would, you know, she would add her fancy things in it. For lunch too, I was known for having the most extravagant lunches amongst my friends. She would go above and beyond by providing us these beautiful lunches that weren't only Chinese food, but also like beautiful sandwiches that she wrapped in wax paper and in twine. And all my friends would just be like, what the heck is that? But I'd open it up and then they'd all steal half of it and ask my mom to make them one too.
I mean, he's been a very good kid since day one. But the thing is, going to work with him is another story. I mean, and I admire him now because of his persistence and his intellectual side of the business that I've never seen before. I'm really proud of him, you know, of what he's doing. And then, of course, we do have conflicts because I would nag sometimes. He goes, oh, Mom, you know, I would nag about the food and say, hey, what's wrong? I've been gone one day and why is the food taste different? And then I would say, you know, hey, he's not doing a good job. You know, why is my dish changed a little bit? So things like that he would think that I'm nitpicking. Actually, this is how I see food as, you know, the sweetness, the saltiness, the you know, whatever it is that I'm accustomed to. So my palate is already, you know what is wrong with the food. And then, on the other side, you know, the business side, you know, I let him do what he does because he's doing a really, really good job and he knows what he's doing. I think it's actually get us closer together. And I know him better than before and he knows me. So we kind of trying to get to know each other more and more.
I mean, at the end of the day, they're my mom's recipes and she's very protective of them. And I try to respect that as much as possible because at the end of the day, I wouldn't have Woon without Mom. You know, the Woon is essentially my mom's, you know, recipes. When we first opened this place, we had to train the staff and we had to train them with no specific, you know, recipes and with measurements or anything like that. So we had to do that along the way. And you know, my mom at the time when I first opened this restaurant, she was going through radiation because she had been diagnosed with breast cancer, you know, right after I signed the lease on this place. So she was coming from radiation, going straight to the kitchen and training our staff right after radiation. And she did it because of, you know, she did it for me and she did it for Woon, which is, you know, I highly respect and I will never forget. Prior to COVID, she was in the kitchen every single day, like 8 to 10 hours a day. And, you know, it got to the point where I was like, I kept telling her she didn't need to do that, but she was obviously very protective of her recipes and, you know, her name was on the recipes. And, you know, she started to make connections with customers. So she felt like if she wasn't there when they came, she felt like they'd be missing out on something. And I remember, you know, March 13th is when we decided it would be her last day in the kitchen until it was safe again. And little did we know that would be, you know, over a year later. But, you know, honestly, for me, I think it was a good thing because there needed to be a time for my mom to step out of the kitchen and for the kitchen to be able to run itself. So in a sense, I think it really did help us evolve and it helped us take it to the next step of the business. You know, she was still very involved during COVID, actually. She would send me text messages and our sous chef. And she would ask him to send him photos of the pork belly and everything. So, you know, she wasn't physically there, but I think she was still there in a sense.
If you come to Woon, I would recommend first off the noodles. It has to be the noodles, because this is very special. I would also recommend having our fried chicken, which is marinated in a special sauce that I do. And many others, you know, like fish cakes is another something that you don't normally see outside. It's more like, you know, a thing that I created when the kids were little, you know, is fish paste, you know, I marinate the fish paste, you know, season it, and then stuff it into a little pocket tofu pockets, and then we fry it. And then, you know, like the salads, like Keegan's favorite is the bean curd salad with cucumber, you know, with a little hint of spice to it, you know, like chili and our own marinade. And the pork belly is to die for, I would say so. We cook it like for 3 hours on the stove. And then so all the umami, all the taste is in that pork belly. And then we serve it with a bao and also all the trimmings like marinated cucumbers, carrots, and also the mustard greens. So these are all our specialties that people come and eat. And when the season is like the summer season comes along, then we will have the radish. We call this the smashed radish. I ate it since I was little because my mom used to make it. And we smashed the radish and then we put like green onions and other, and also a special dressing onto it. And so these are all food that is pretty popular at Wuhan.
Julie Chen, a.k.a. Mama Fong, and Keegan Fong are the mother-son duo behind Wuhan Kitchen in L.A.'s historic Filipino town. Coming up, suckling pig tacos, anyone? Stay tuned for the most exciting tacos in L.A. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Let's finish off this week's show with a bite of something super delicious. Food writer and cookbook author Bill Esparza is here with a recommendation for a taco that you won't want to miss.
I have to say that it's the most exciting taco for me right now in Los Angeles. And I had just tried this in Nayarit before the pandemic on a trip I made out there. And it's whole suckling pig. And, you know, we do have this tradition in different parts of Mexico, actually, where my family's from, in Aguascalientes and a few other places. But in the city of Acaponeta, Nayarit, this tradition is probably the best version of it because of the condiments and the way they do it. It's called puerquito echado. They don't call it lechon where they're from. Puerquito echado is really named because of the way the pig is laying flat and butterflied, the suckling pig. So it's a whole suckling pig that's cooked in a stainless steel box, similar to a cajachina. But this guy does it for 5 hours and gets this beautiful, you know, the skin is crispy. I feel like I'm in a fine dining restaurant and I just have tortillas, which is like the ultimate, my goal in life is to go to fine dining restaurants that have tortillas.
Yes. And, oh, yes.
Yeah. And the best thing about it is it has a mustard salsa. And I know what you're thinking and like, come on, mustard salsa. But it's just got a touch of mustard in the actual salsa. One is made with tomatillos and it's very mild. And another is made with tomatillos and chiles güeros. And so you get a little bit of a spicier salsa, but with just a hint of mustard in there. It's the yellow stuff, you know, there's no fancy mustard in there.
So are these the kind of lechon tacos where you get a little bit of lots of different parts of the pig?
Well, and this taco, they're going to put the meat on. It's very tender. It's simply seasoned with salt and really fresh suckling pig flavor. So they put that on there. And then he layers that mustard salsa that has raw onions that are basically put in. You know, when he opens up the salsa, he dumps these raw onions in there. That's the whole thing. You don't need anything else but the salsa. And he also puts some cabbage on there. You get a piece of crispy skin. But the real trick here, the real move is to ask for a crispy pata. So there's definitely different parts of the pig. You can ask for anything you want on there, but you always get a piece of skin with your order, but you can add feet and any other crispy parts that you want. And I always get the pata on there to basically chase my taco.
So we haven't said his name. Tell us who this person is and where we can find it.
Okay, so the taquero for Los Sabrosos is David Delfin, and he is in the city of Cari. And right now he's on Patata Street, which is, it's like a dirt road in a little industrial area. And there's a bunch of taquerias and street stands that have opened up there. So right now, if you go for Los Sabrosos al Horno, which means the delicious oven roasted tacos, if you go there and try their tacos, which you have to, but there's a bunch of stands out there right now. There's birria, there's another place is doing tejuinos.
What are tejuinos? Correct.
Tejuinos are a traditional beverage from Jalisco and Nayarit and other Pacific Coast parts that has, it's a fermented masa drink.
And there's been a bit of a conversation on social media about the proper way of pronouncing the city where this is. So I grew up hearing that it was called Cudahy, the super white version. What is the correct?
Oh, yeah.
What is the correct way?
Well, this is a Latino, Mexican, and Central American Latinx dominant part of the city. So even, you know, Bell Gardens is pronounced with a Spanish accent, you know, Bell. But so we just say Cudahy.
Cudahy. Okay.
Yeah. You know, Montebello. Come on.
Awesome.
They're all our barrios.
Well, this is awesome. Thank you so much, Bell, for telling us about Los Sabrosos.
Oh, you have to go.
I will. I promise.
Okay. Yeah, that's an order.
Okay.
Thank you, Evan.
That was Bill Esparza, food writer, cookbook author, and friend of the show. He first wrote about Los Sabrosos for Eater LA. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Lyra Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, Gary Masiha, and John Meek. I'm Evan Kleiman. To all the moms out there, I hope you're doing whatever it is that pleases you this weekend. And to anyone celebrating your mom this weekend, don't forget at least to wash all the dishes. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.